Listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you now through April 15th at kboo.fm/ATNF4.
as part of the All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. Comics Take co-host, comedian Kimberly Nickel, is producing a stand-up comedy show celebrating Women's History Month with a full cast of not dude comedians, sharing their best PG-13 rated jokes. The show will be live for an audience on Friday, March 28th at 6:30 p.m. Set your intentions, save your seat, RSVP at kboo.fm/comedy. KBOO Studio will be filled with an audience enjoying puns, impressions, and cocktails. It'll be better with you there. Join us in the back of KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland on Friday, March 28th, 6:30 p.m. This event will be recorded and played on the radio waves on Monday, March 31st at 10 p.m. Donations to KBOO are encouraged. If you don't show up on the 28th, no one will hear your laughter on the 31st.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and
what's up, y'all? This is Tupac, a.k.a. Machiavelli the Don, and I ain't mad at you.
This is Reverend Jeremiah Wright. You're tuning in to High Knock. Yo, keep it real, right?
One more time, because they're not gonna believe it was you.
This is Reverend Jeremiah Wright Jr., and you're tuned in to High Knock. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for your support. God bless you.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. We've been doing a number of shows focused on some of the recent policy decisions of this current administration, how that's trickling down, how that's impacting people in real time. One of the big ones has been around the Department of Education and the underlying issues that are connected to it. So it's not just the Trump administration saying, look, we want to shut down the Department of Education, but they've also been pushing a lot of schools, public and private, to adhere to their worldview, which includes getting rid of diversity, equity, and inclusion. It has gone down the pipe of saying they don't want to see ethnic studies being taught at some schools, and every school has to have some sort of policy that firmly aligns itself in against anti-Semitism, but anti-Semitism in this case is just even having a critique of Israel's policies. And so that's among the many things that are on the table. And I wanted to talk to somebody who's been in the forefront of dealing with this way before the Trump administration. His name is Mike Benitez, and he's a dean or has been a dean, and these are things up your purview. But I wanted to have you on because one of the things that has been happening is a lawsuit, and a lot of people have not heard about that, and I'm hoping maybe you could shed some light onto that as well. So welcome to the show, Mike Benitez. Did I miss anything in describing you or the scenario that's going on?
My brother, David D, man, always a pleasure to kick it with you. Thanks for inviting me onto the show. And I mean, just to address and talk about this important moment, this this historic moment, right? This unprecedented moment, it all matters. There's a lot going on the political spectrum, and yet there's so much to be understood about the way that political pendulums run. So to your point, yeah, I'm a vice president in higher ed. That said, I'm not here speaking for my role, not for the university that I work for. I'm speaking here as an independent scholar and independent community and cultural worker. And same thing, I'm not here speaking for any institutions, organizations, or boards that I serve on. I'm here speaking as just Mike B, who is informed and has a voice, and speaking from my own perspective, just to shine in on the conversation. Yeah, there's a lot going on, brother, and this laws. And it's important that we understand, right, the difference between laws. And I'm no lawyer, but I pay attention to this real closely. A lot of what's coming down is guidance. It's processes. It's sort of like, hey, be on the lookout for because this is how we're redefining or interpreting, if not redefining, really just this is our interpretation, this administration's interpretation of some of the civil rights laws dealing with, you know, what someone might often refer to as protected identities. Minoritized students will fall into that, but it's not just minoritized students. It's not just race and ethnicity. You're talking about vets. You know, you talk about people with disabilities. We talk about people who are neurodivergent. We talk about women and representation of women. We're talking about queer and GLBQ and the transgender communities. We talk about undocumented students and particularly within the context of higher education and sort of a lot of the threats and the misinformation and miseducation that has been put out there around what diversity, equity, and inclusion represent. And it's important for me to kind of mark it out and articulate it as diversity, equity, and inclusion, because I believe that part of us conflating those three into one word called DEI, and then we take a B and add it in there for belonging, and then we talk a J and add it in there for justice, and it's like, you know, all these different acronyms, and when we're not clear about those acronyms, then those words, by way of their intent and the mending, the reconciling, the addressing disparate outcomes, right, that's kind of key in creating parity in the success and outcomes of different populations, it's really what's key here. And that's what our folks are not making clear, everything from the you know, answers and interpretation provided to the Dear Colleague letter, to a lot of the executive orders that have been coming down around expectations for institutions to allegedly stop discriminating in what they view or they're interpreting. And in the Dear Colleague letter, it kind of spelled out Asian and white students. And in other places, you know, the idea of affirmative action and the way that that's, you know, used and has been leveraged and utilized. And I think that these all represent something very different for different institutions. That's a reality. If you're a research one institution, it's going to land differently. If it's if you're a research two or liberal arts, or if you're a modified open access institution, or you're a community college or for profit, right? These laws, or at least this executive orders and guidance that still need to make the process and their way through courts. There are, you know, quite a bit of states that have certainly passed some of these laws at the state level, and you know, Texas, Florida, amongst them, you know, included. I believe Kansas might have just also passed the law, and so that's also happening at the state level. But writ large, I think what's important here for people to understand is that beyond those states that have passed laws based on the push and the guidance from this administration and its transition, these are not laws, but we still need to be attentive and cautious. The biggest threat to all of these, and you said it at the opening, is the dangers to democracy, is the danger to academic freedom, to freedom of speech, to the ability to even organize peacefully, right? The idea of demonizing protests or peaceful protests, or just galvanizing to express dissent towards something unpopular that kind of goes against democratic values are all part of the conversation. Yes, sir.
Right. That's the voice of Mike B. Talking to us about some of these new rulings as they pertain to higher ed, and looking at some of the pushback or the resistance to it. Let me walk back into time, Mike. We had you on this show several years ago. Yeah. And I want to bring this up because I think it's important that we always have historical context to yes. things. Because when we had you on, the outcry was not loud at all. People felt like, well, that's their problem. It ain't my problem. And this is when you actually showed me a contract, remember, uh-huh. that had a bunch of words that you were not allowed to say when mm-hmm. you went to speak, right?
And in the state of Iowa.
In the state of Iowa, but then there were, there was similar type of contracts that speakers were required to deal with in every place from Colorado to Florida. And in these contracts, now this is a whole different thing. Like, if you want to speak at our university, you can't say the word white supremacy. You can't say, you know, it kind of mirrors some of the things we're saying now, but it was spelled out. And they used the whole thing of like, well, you just won't get paid. You know, you come here and, you know, you can say all this stuff if you want, but we just won't pay you. And so now we're seeing that defunding model scaled up. Hey, you know, we don't want you to do a certain thing, take a certain position. And if not, you know, instead of maybe a few hundred dollars or a couple of thousand dollars for a speaking gig, now we'll take away half a million or half a billion or whatever it was, you know, for research, which, you know, proved to be very effective. So a couple of things. One, when this happened, Mike, a lot of people didn't really kick up dust. Now, I don't know if they didn't understand, if they didn't know, or if they thought that maybe this will pass and they'll survive it. But that was the canary in the coal mine when those things started to happen. And it wasn't unknown. I mean, you came on the show. Rosa Clemente talked about it. I had a number of people just on our show. I know on some of the legacy media outlets like your MSNBC, they talked about it. So what happened that people just kind of fell asleep at the wheel and just didn't either care or fight back then?
Yeah, man. I mean, you know, I think we can attribute this, and I'm glad you brought that historical context and sort of that work or that talk in Iowa at the end. You know, it was for Dr. King, a keynote for Dr. King Day, Dr. Martin Luther King, the Reverend.
That's
Dr.
right.
King.
And it was on that day you couldn't say those words.
Yeah, and I wasn't able to utilize words like structural racism or systemic racism or privilege, you know, things like that. And, you know, at the end, though, you know, we're able to talk about these issues. I don't necessarily have to use those words. You could kind of describe the outcomes. You could describe the ways in which policies and procedures privilege particular the representations of certain demographics culturally and politically, geographically, everything from defunding. In this case, you know, they would have paid me, but then they would have gotten in trouble, right? That's the issue. That's where they're sort of holding the fire to the feet, is by saying that you're gonna get fined, and we're gonna you know, these are, you know, school districts or institutions that are already not well funded and struggle with you know, funding. And so to come out and say, yeah, we're gonna, you know, fine you however many thousands of dollars if you engage in A, B, C, and or D, man, it's wild, because it really is a hit to American democracy. It really is a hit to people's ability to be able to engage civically and with civility and respectfully with different issues. And I think my biggest challenge with what's going on right now is you got folks on, you know, very particular, you know, aspects of this issues, maybe more conservative and to some degree more extreme, that are very bluntly speaking in ways that are discriminatory, and yet they want to kind of offer and put forward and impose discourses and processes that are preventing folks on the other side, call that a bit more liberal or in the more extreme sort of left, to be able to just simply express voice, express dissent. Nobody's engaging violently. Nobody is destroying property. Nobody is threatening to destroy or hurt somebody else. And so as long as that happens, and that's the beauty of academia, is that academia needs to be able to hold on to all sides, man. I'm the first one to say, hey, nah, you're telling me that they can express a feeling or a sentiment or an opinion or a perspective, no matter how in a lot of unfortunate situations, insensitive or dismissive or lacking compassion or unempathetic it is. Folks are able to, right? That's the beauty of this nation, just simply express different perspectives. And that, for me, is one of probably the biggest dangers associated with what's going on.
Well, let me come back to this, Mike B. I still want to stay in this arena of what happened a few years ago.
Yes, right? Yes.
Because there was plenty of time for people to do something about
that's
that.
That's right.
You know, plenty of time. This was like during the first Trump administration, when you started to see all these laws being passed statewide and attacks on what they call wokenism. So I want to come back to this. The thing that stands out for me is seeing a not only a limitation put on what you can and can't say, but then, as you said, they had enshrined laws so that, hey, if you say this, we will fine you. Now, the question becomes, and this is what I'm getting at, how would they know you said this? So what we found, you know, I don't know if this was in Iowa, but I definitely know in Florida, because we had a a lawyer. We had a federal lawyer on, you know, so that the judge, he came on. He teaches, and he says in his class, students are allowed to record, and in fact, they're encouraged to record and to report anything that makes them feel uncomfortable. So it's not even a set of words. It was just what makes you feel uncomfortable. So I'm sitting there and go, you know, I don't like the way that he said, you know, white supremacy or something like that, or, you know, his conversation on race. So that then can lead to an investigation. And in his case, in the university, they can remove you from the classroom. Or if it's a state law, they can start, you know, fining the school, right? So to me, this is crazy. So in other words, you have people sitting in the audience just to make sure that Mike B doesn't say certain words: white privilege, structural racism, white supremacy. Now, I'm bringing this up because here we are 4 or 5 years later. What are they doing at Columbia University? They're saying, well, we're going to monitor and put into receivership your classes. So now if I'm speaking in a class, I have somebody there that's literally like the police that can come in and make sure that my lesson and my conversation with my students are not something that violates whatever guidelines, as you said, these are guidelines that they feel are comfortable. To me, people should be outraged, and they weren't. So,
well,
I'm going to come down this pipe now. I'm looking at different populations. You named off a number of them. And my question is, how have they responded? Not just now, but how have they responded then? If they were smashing on black folks, how did black folks respond? You know, how did the NAACP and these other organizations respond to that? If they're Latino, how did they respond? Were they up in DC? Were they kicking over desks? If they're LGBT, because those laws were coming fast and hard, were large organizations speaking? You know, like I'm looking at GLAAD, and I remember at the time they didn't have anything to say, but they sure had press releases and press conferences about Little Baby at the time. Remember, he said something crazy, and they was all out in the thing. But when these laws were being put into place statewide, where were they? And we can go on and on. Now, we did see response. We saw it with conservative, you know, with Ed Blumenthal or Ed Blum, who got the conservative Asian folks. We saw them responding and being in the forefront to say, we feel we're being discriminated against. And they were looking under every rock and cranny to go after people who, you know, from people who weren't even in university, saying, I just want to make sure black folks can get a, you know, a loan from me, a private loan. And they were suing them. So where was our movement, people? Where were we on this when this were being put into place stateside in at least 4 or 5 different places?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, wow, that's a complex question, but let me try to break it down, perhaps even starting from a place of what happens when folks begin to become complacent and to some degree fearful. But we'll start with complacency, because those are two very, you know, different things. You know, the first one is when you think about even going back to the civil rights movement and the era, and we're not far removed from the era, and we're still in the movement. I don't know when folks speak historically to the civil rights movement being something of the past. You know, we've been in the thick of it for a minute. That never stopped. That's why it's called a movement. It's multi-generational. So that's one. Two, right? when you're dealing with inclusion, inclusion is not just a word that, you know, somebody was, to keep it practical, sitting around the table one day was like, oh, I have a brilliant idea, I'm innovative. Inclusion, no. Inclusion as a practice was a very particular effort to uproot and stand against exclusion, the very real legal practice of exclusion. That's an important piece to highlight around the way in which inclusion was introduced politically to the discourse of politics and education and workplaces. It just didn't pop out of nowhere. It wasn't just some idea. It was literally a move to create equality. And then the same thing when you think about equity by way of the outcomes, you know, whether it's access to space, access to resources within that space, the cultivation and preparation of that space to assure that folks that enter those spaces now who weren't able to not only enter those spaces before, but who weren't in mind when those spaces were created. So there's also a disconnect culturally with different people, depending on what the space is. And then the outcomes, right? That we begin to achieve a sense of parity around who is succeeding across a variety of social identities. So we move beyond that. And we start to initiate and integrate these practices into law, into education, into public service, into industry, right? Not only through civil rights acts, and there's quite a bit of them, whether it's ADA, you know, whether it's speaking to EOE and protected identities, whether it's the Title IX, Title VII, you know, all those kind of compliance laws. Now the work is no longer belongs to the community pushing against systems and saying, hey, you got to do better by us. So when we start to fill those roles, and by the way, for folks out there, affirmative action, when you look at the first 20, 30 years, largely benefited white women followed by black men. When you look at a lot of that data, that's important to know. And even as you look at the way affirmative action has or has not impacted, it didn't necessarily lead to a great increase. Still, at most institutions, especially selective ones, particularly black and indigenous populations are incredibly underrepresented, you know, in percentage and in ratio and in parity. That said, when that happens, and I remember one of the first things, presentations and papers I worked on called Revisiting Activism in the Age of Conformity in the early 2000s, focused on the apathy, right? The, okay, we no longer have to struggle for that work. It's now part of the system. They're letting us into the space. I could get a job now. I could get an education. I have access to resources, whatever that looks like. And folks got comfortable. They somehow thought that, and we still see this, that there's no need to struggle and to continue to push or to keep our eye on the prize. It's sort of the sentiment that things are generally okay, and there's also a lot of individual sort of elements to this. I'm good, and so, you know, y'all got this. Y'all take care of you because I'm taking care of me. So I think a big part of the reaction and why folks, it's not that they're not caring or they're not upset or frustrated at that time, the first presidency, by what's going on, because it didn't start there neither. One has to look at things like Project 2025, Claremont Institute, Manhattan Institute, and other spaces where this conversation has been happening for quite some time before we got to where we're at, right? The generational preparation to eventually get here. Folks not really studying and understanding things like power, things like decision making, things like whose knowledge and who's making the decisions around what is valid or not valid, and how they want, you know, the systems to work or prioritize in ways that just kind of don't make sense for different human beings. Hence, right, diversity. And in discomfort, just finish that one there. In discomfort and complacency, folks just are looking at this like this is gonna pass, and you know, we're gonna go somewhere and this is gonna pass and we're gonna be okay. And for the first time, Davey, you know, folks are getting a real awakening. Folks are getting a real awakening about how serious this is, from a place of removing one's rights, from violating the constitutional process, from taking away this thing that it, even though it should be readily given, it's not. And this goes to sort of the struggle and the sacrifice and the having to kind of fight for space and place across this variety of organizations and different systemic entities here in the U.S. So there is anger out there. There is frustration. I see it. But there's also a lot of fear. A lot of fear because a lot of people, economically speaking, you know, and we've seen this, a lot of people have already lost their jobs, or their jobs have been refunctioned to do different work in those same spaces. A lot of the work around diversity and equity and inclusion in a lot of higher institutions of higher ed has been removed. And a lot of institutions are responding in that way because they're so tied to federal funding that can risk that.
I don't want to let this off the hook.
No, please don't.
There are individuals that obviously benefit from policies. And if we're talking about students, we're talking about somebody who just got out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
18, 19 years old. Maybe they're going to grad school, so they might be in their early 20s. And they're still trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get that, you know. So, you know, and that kind of gets recycled every few years, right? We're talking about, there's a difference with individuals dealing with institutions. So we saw institutional clapback. Let me put something into legislation. Let me bring lawsuits with well-financed individuals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't expect the 18-year-old to have a worldview of this whole thing and be able to be equipped to fight back. But I do expect institutions that have been around 30, 40, 50 years, and institutions that, on one hand, can come out full throttle, you know, when you do something. So I mentioned GLAAD as an example. They went heavy after a rapper, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've been in those spaces, you know, they weren't, I didn't see no press release from them. NAACP, same thing, right? You know, go hard in the paint for this, but out, you know, absent here. You mentioned white women being a major beneficiary of all these policies. And not only did we not see a complete pushback, you know, because the way they defined the privilege and white supremacy and all that, even though that was coming down a lane in which they were able to benefit, it was like, that's not my problem. And we can go on and on down the list, you know, pick an organization and look at how they were responding to those types of scenarios that were very prevalent in some major states. Florida's a big state. Texas is a big state, right? I mean, they have teachers' unions. You have historically black colleges. You have the whole nine, right? Arizona, big state. You know, well, I mean, not population-wise, but, you know, so I'm looking at where were the institutions. Now, maybe those institutions have a lot on their plate, so let's take it up a step further.
Mm-hmm.
That's the institution that was putting these things into place, where, you know, the face of it was legislators. Where were our legislators? Where were the Democrats on this thing when people were running for president and for Senate and for Congress? Was that an issue? Did they bring people like you in a room and say, Mike, you know, Mike, you know, for people who don't know, Mike is not a joke. He's pretty high ranking cat that's well known. We're not giving all your affiliations because of that, but you're in a lot of these spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So did they bring you, and I can name off a dozen other people who I know they didn't have a conversation with back then, just to say, what can we do, Mr. Benitez? What do you think needs to happen? What sort of legislation should we be crafting? There was an absence of it, which leads me to this. When I saw the capitulation of Columbia, and I'm seeing the backpedaling of some of these other institutions, considering that they have resources, knowing that they have a lot of fight, you know, a lot of things, I'm beginning to wonder if this is what they actually wanted. I think Columbia was like, yeah, man, you know, like, you know, we'll pretend, quotations around the word, we'll pretend to be upset, quotations around the word upset, but Go ahead, have at it. Shut these protests down. Get rid of these students. And, you know, we don't want to have to really deal with diversity, inclusion, I mean, equity and inclusion. That's what it's looking like. They're letting this administration do the dirty work that they were too afraid to do, or, you know, they're trying to hedge their bets. But it's kind of like, hey, man, if you want to kick them down the stairs, I ain't going to fight. And Columbia is a perfect example because of the deans that they have in place, how they cooperated. All that sort of stuff just says to me, you really wanted this to happen. And some of these organizations, I think, really wanted this to happen, especially in the legislative place, because they were absent from the fight then, and they're absent from the fight now.
Yeah, you know, Davey, oh, man. I mean, I could respond to that in so many ways, but if I have to offer my perspectives, look, let's start with this, man. Systems are systems. Most of these institutions outside of HBCUs, tribal colleges in particular, were not created with diversity of human representation in mind. That's important. That's important because it speaks to the foundation and histories of institutions like Columbia, other Ivy Leagues, other highly selective institutions. Now, you know, it's been years since those foundations have been set. But those years have produced a legacy. They've produced generational wealth. They've produced what I deem a sort of an illusion of prestige and a certain mindset that they operate from. And because they've built heavy research enterprises, and those research enterprises are highly dependent on federal dollars, whether that's Department of Ed, NSF, you know, wherever those dollars are coming from. And you talk about Columbia. Man, you're talking outward of more than half a million, probably even billions, in federal dollars, you know, to fund a lot of their research practices. You lose those funds. You lose not just the ability to execute and carry on and engage, you know, this important research. You also lose people. People lose their jobs. You lose capacity. You lose the ability to fund a lot of things. So I do think there's a part of these institutions, Columbia included, that, are probably enjoying and kind of saying about time, because this has been going forever and I can't stand this. But I also think there's a lot of people in those spaces that care and have their hands tied. And if they raise their voice or express voice, look at what happened at that, you know, associated with Columbia. The one cat that started to speak out, who I believe is maybe a post grad or a grad student or a young professor of sorts, and now the administration, you know, he was arrested and or detained.
Right.
And
Muhammad, Muhammad.
Yeah, Khalil. Yeah, Muhammad. Thank you. So you got this brother. So everybody has that fear that that's what's going to happen. And you know, those are the beginning stages, man.
We're talking about students versus people who represent an institution, right? Again, I want to come back to seeing how those institutions have responded or not responded over a period of years. Now we're in the 11th hour. Everything is cooking. But these things, like the fact that you would have as a legislative act, somebody giving you an official thing from the state saying you can't say these words, otherwise the school will get fined and you won't get paid, should have rung alarm bells in 2016 or 17, whenever it is that we
or even before that.
Right.
Or even before that.
Right. So that's one thing. The fact that we're seeing that money can be withheld, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow, I didn't know you could really use that as a tool. Why wasn't there no executive orders, you know, even under Biden, to say, look, man, if you're going to continue on this anti-wokeness thing, how about we just withhold federal fundings on you in all these universities in Florida, right? Because mm-hmm. that was in the tool chest, and you didn't do that at all. You sat back and you was like, oh, you're gonna eliminate books from schools, right? You know, you're going to eliminate textbooks. You're going to get rid of ethnic studies classes on the state level, and you're sitting there controlling the Senate and the presidency. You couldn't sit up there and say, you know what, Florida, you ain't getting no funding if you keep this up. You couldn't do that. you know, just seeing like, wow, how much things can be flexed and how much stuff was not flexed tells me that you wanted this to happen. You saw this. You're not dumb. You're in these positions. You can read the tea leaves. If you were talking about it 4 or 5 years ago, they knew about it, you know, that long ago and decided not to do anything. And I guess the realization for a lot of us is realizing like, yo, these people are in on the game too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the thing here, Davey, is that, you know, to some degree, man, you're absolutely right in how people are receiving this and the way that it's landing. And to some degree, even institutions and those at the top not leaning in, although not all, man. If you look across, there's a variety of especially some of the Jesuit institutions who are saying this, hey, man, this just goes against our mission. There's a lot of institutions that are now coming out. Natahi, who, you know, came out and put that lawsuit forward and won the temporary injunction, has been lifted, and now the onus has been put on institutions to be able to demonstrate how they're not discriminating. But that lawsuit also offered some confidence, finally, for a lot of different associations that represent the employees, whether that's faculty-based associations, discipline-based associations.
Let's take a step back and tell us about this lawsuit or what you know about it or heard about with respect, you know?
Yeah, no, you know, what this lawsuit, you know, basically did was it put forward an argument around...
What is the name of the lawsuit?
The lawsuit was ran by the Democracy Forward. Okay. Natahi among... there's three other plaintiffs in it, you know, folks can find it. I don't remember the lawsuit particular, but it's not versus the Trump administration, it's versus the executive orders, right? Okay. I think that needs to be made clear that came out basically saying all DEI activity, jobs, funding, promotion need to stop. And here's the repercussions if they don't. And then argued for a harm, right? A very particular harm that is being caused and kind of gathering narratives and ways in which these executive orders are causing harm economically, but also in other ways, mental well-being, to systems, to the ability for institutions to execute on their mission, things of that nature. That's important. Right. And now, you know, you have the new panel that kind of looked at it, that actually had the fair balance of a Democrat and Republican representation kind of lifted and say, all right, let's go ahead and offer an opportunity for institutions to now just demonstrate how they are not being discriminatory. But the reality is that a lot of these institutions, part of their mission, right, is to be as diverse, as inclusive, right? They should take pride in who they include, not who they exclude. And in some ways, man, this is the irony of this word, Davey V, is that it's putting institutions in a place where they're saying, oh man, no, and why, and this shouldn't be happening, and they're pushing back to the extent, or some people within those institutions are kind of expressing some dissent or fight back, right? But the systems are also the systems, the institutions themselves, even though the people within them are pushing back, they're not the ones necessarily making the decisions. So now the onus is on institutions to demonstrate how they are not. And then you saw that recent list that came out that identified 50 institutions because of a particular work that is being interpreted as discriminatory, in some cases a partnership with the PhD project that focuses really on kind of exposing a pipeline to people from backgrounds that normally wouldn't see themselves, in this case business as a discipline, as PhDs, and the hope that it could galvanize interest in pursuing degrees or PhD degrees and PhDs. But even in that case, right, nobody's really excluding the opportunity. The focus is really on what are the issues, but everybody is welcome to contribute to space, Nobody is being said, no, you're not allowed and you can't even speak here or enter the space. No, anyone can contribute to the conversation, but the issues are the issues, no different like a class. If you're taking a psychology class, oh, everybody and the mama and the papa and grandpa could come and take the class and be part of the conversation, but the topic is psychology. Now, if you want to go talk about physics, then you go take a physics class, and everybody's welcome to come and talk about that topic, too.
Mike Benitez is our guest this afternoon. Part of what has been driving this, well, has accelerated, because it's been around for a minute, but we've seen the acceleration of this type of oppression or repression, was with the pro-Zionist groups, you know, who pretty much were also playing the same card. You know, we'll defund or we'll pull back our donations, yada, yada, yada. We need a fast and hard line drawn in the sand. If anybody even criticizes Israel, we're considering that anti-Semitic, and we want to make sure, you know, that critique is vigorously enforced. Like, there can be no critique. And there was no real institutional pushback on that, you know, especially considering what you just laid out. You go to a classroom, everybody should have a perspective, you know, and I teach, people come from all different sides, you know, and it's made clear that everybody has a say, so this is safe space for everybody. You don't get to, you know, make it very unwelcoming for people because they have a different understanding. That's how classrooms are supposed to do. And as a professor, your job is to encourage them that if they speak, to have not just an opinion, but an informed opinion. Where did you get that, Mike? You said the world is flat. Okay, what is this based on? And, you know, we may not agree with the data, but at least you'd be able to say, look, back in the 16th century, the Greeks believed, and, you know, and I read this, and this is the argument that was made. So people get to come with that. But at this point, we're dealing with not even having that as a discussion at all on one side of the equation. So if I go into a class right now and they decide, as they used to in the 70s and in the 60s and the 50s, to literally say that slavery wasn't that bad, that, you know, that the slaves were like family. This footage, you know, you could see people talking about that online. I mean, from back in the days where it was described as a benign type of institution and people need to get over it. That sort of ideology can still be taught, right? You know, as you're seeing, we remove slavery from textbooks. We call enslaved Africans immigrants. We don't describe what happened with indigenous folks as genocide. Those types of things are, you know, being taught and being required for you to have to master in order to get a degree. But if you come there and say, look, you know, I was in the Africana class and they had a whole other perspective on this, that is now literally being erased and outlawed and considered some sort of discrimination. If we want to talk about the Middle East and, you know, we want to, you know, talk about things from a Zionist point of view, that's allowed. But if you want to come up here and say, you know, I think there are some flaws in this analysis, all of a sudden your anti-Semitic and funding is being removed. This is crazy, especially considering what the purpose of the universities and classrooms and education is supposed to be about. And just on that principle alone, to see the deafening silence from folks that hold lofty titles has been, you know, alarming and profoundly sad. It says to me, this is what you want to have happen. Hakeem Jeffries, this is what you want to have happen. Chuck Schumer, this is what you want to have happen. Nancy Pelosi, this is actually what you want to have happen, because the resources that you have to fight are nowhere to be seen. I see more people protesting over here at the lake around this, which I give them props, than I do folks who have these resources.
Who are in positions and who were voted and elected by the people to advocate on behalf of these issues, on behalf of these rights, on behalf of education systems to teach all parts of American history, Mexican American history, Black history, right? I mean, we could go down the road, absolutely, Davey, and that's a big part of the issue. And I do think, right, this is a part where folks have to understand more deeply, right? Things like white supremacy is not about the KKK, that's part of it. White supremacy is not about neo-Nazis, that's part of it. White supremacy is epistemic conditioning. Is white supremacy really deals with who gets to dictate what we say holds true or valid, even against the facts laid out in front of you. And to your point, right, when you think about enslavement or the 1619 project and the such a well-written piece or Ibram Kendi's Stamped from the Beginning, those are some of the more recent ones. But this is the ability to be able to teach all this stuff and to present it, right, for what it is. And you know what? That includes history related to white folks, too. I mean, period of time historically when Irish people were not considered as equals and were, you know, bashed and marginalized. And eventually there's work out there that speaks to the ways in which even Irish immigrants understood the ways in which adapting a sense of white sensibilities around American whiteness benefited them and didn't put them in precarious positions. And the same thing with Italians and other white Europeans over time. And to your point, yes, I mean, what's wild about this is the ability for the silencing to be able to take place and for the fight to not be taken to that level to really address the democracy. But then again, I mean, when she was running, Kamala Harris, you know, she did make some points around this is for the democracy. But I think that there was a lot
that was such
missed.
That was vague.
It was very vague.
You know, to say this is for the democracy is very different than saying A, B, C, and D should not be allowed
absolutely.
To go down on my watch.
Absolutely. It was vague, but it also spoke to, let's keep it real here. Let's go deeper, bro. When we think about sensibilities, man, I mean, a lot of people who are just unaware historically of how we've gotten to where we are. Now, I wasn't surprised when data came out that said that Latino males or Latinos who are normally Catholic are also now finding common ground with even evangelism and some of those values and the role kind of religion and values play, whether that's abortion or whether that's folks lack of understanding around GLBQ plus and transgender rights or human rights, or I disagree. But here's the thing that I think a lot of people are missing. Folks are more than welcome to have their own thinking, their freedom to express themselves, the freedom and liberty to have their own thoughts and perspectives and formed opinions. But what is ugly about this is the moment you start to use those perspectives, Davey, to clout and to prevent another human being from getting the same rights that you have as a human being, that's when it becomes an issue. And that's what's happening here. And that's what folks in power, advocates, legislators, council at the local, state, and federal levels need to be really advocating is that, okay, beyond the I believe this and you believe that, what does it mean to remove and make impossible the ability for another human being to have access to the resources or to just be able to have the same rights that I have as a human being?
You know, Mike, as we wrap up, Len would say, folks for a very long time were policing language.
Mm-hmm.
They were policing terminology that people, you know, so if you said something wrong, you didn't have the right language, then you got dragged across the coals. And maybe people felt themselves because some of the people that they were dragging across the coals did one of two things.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them said, well, hell, I'm going to align myself with the orange tyrant because he's clapping back and I'm enjoying the clap back, right? Because I feel like I was misunderstood, or maybe I felt uncomfortable giving up power and resources or what have you. But if you were going to go for the king's throat, you better hit him, you know, and people swung. And now that person said, well, you missed, you know, and now I'm going to use every resource that I have to completely bury you, 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 and you, mm-hmm. you know, and you could see it almost surgically, like mm-hmm. if you had a problem with pronouns, I'm going after you. If you said white privilege, I'm going after you. If you said women's rights, I'm going after you, all the way down the line, right? I'm going to go specifically after you. And it's not just going after, I'm going to punish you. I'm going to make sure that you are completely upended, right?
Yeah.
Which
it's very, you know, it's very immoral technique when he said it's more than racism, it's staying your place-ism.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the fact is that, you know, if there's a mistake, maybe people should have said, well, look, we got a fort and we can completely withstand this. Or maybe people feel like they are withstanding it because it hasn't hit them yet. But yeah. like you said, we know a lot of people who it has hit. You know, yeah. we have friends and people that we know that are completely, you know, financially upended, you know,
yeah.
you know, and that's only going to grow.
Yeah.
And we haven't even gotten into, and this is 60 days in, we mm-hmm. haven't gotten into all the stuff that's happening with people trying to return home when they go overseas. We
yeah.
haven't, you know, we haven't dealt with all that. And so there was no institution that we built. And the institution that we were depending upon decided that they're not going to fight this one. It's funny, you know, I've seen people put the meme out with sisters saying we voted 92%, so we're going to drink our coffee and not get involved. But the irony to this, you know who's really not involved? The establishment Democrats. They're the ones that are really sipping coffee and going, you know, like, ho-hum. You know, I got enough money and resources. I'll survive this storm. And they're yeah. sitting back looking from the ivory tower, going, look at all these black, brown, and LGBT, and disabled, and, you know.
And then they wonder. I mean, a real talk. Then they wonder why they weren't able to win the electorate and to capture.
But I don't think they care. I really don't. I don't think they care, especially with the SAVE Act now on the docket,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
to make it almost impossible to vote, at least in federal elections.
Yeah.
I've concluded that this is what they want. They don't care. You know, I'll survive it. I got enough money is what they're saying. I'm a millionaire. Maybe not a billionaire, but I'm a millionaire. Me and you 100 years and 1,000 years at most,
yeah.
you know? and so, you know,
you know, I hear you on that, man. But, you know, I like to think, bro, just push back that I like to think that there is a hope. I like to think that if folks were able to really galvanize and come together and understand what's at stake, including, you know, holding those establishment Democrats, that there is a possibility. But there is an accountability to be had here, especially when we're talking about protecting the rights of all people here in the U.S. And, you know, the thing is, man, I get the turmoil. Man, if you study this generationally, you understand the trauma. One generation comes in, they fight hard, or they come through in their way, and eventually they get to being a citizen. Then they see others come in, maybe not the same way, and they have an idea about, well, this is the right way to do it. And at the end of the road, none of it is the right way. But I think one of the biggest things here that I want to hit on, bro, is the ways in which that very establishment I'm going to mark it. Let me go ahead and mark it and sort of the some of the white liberalism that while altruistic and helpful and caring can also be toxic when it's not truly addressing systemic issues, right, at the policy level to assure that voices are there and that resources are equitably distributed across different communities is this. The conflation of all this entire conversation, bro, into a DEI acronym takes away so much around the ways in which self efforts don't necessarily have to be DEI. And I think that when people are like, oh yeah, Black excellence, oh, that's a DEI thing. Oh, el Centro Cultural, oh, that's an EEI thing. The Jewish Center, yeah, that's a DEI thing. The Muslim advocacy group, that's a DEI thing. The Queer Alliance, that's a DEI thing. You see where I'm going? And so when everybody starts to conflate those into this acronym, and remove the significance of why groups are holding on to just identities that are instrumental to all the entire intersectional being, then people remove the ability for those to exist on their own. Like, Black excellence could hella exist and has for some time without DEI.
Mike Benitez, Dr. Mike Benitez, want to thank you for joining us this afternoon. We're going to take a break on Hard Knocks.
This is Bird Note. If you take a look at birds' wings, you might notice a pattern. Many species have black feathers on the trailing edge of their wings, regardless of what color most of their feathers are. Birds as different as gulls, pelicans, storks, and flamingos all have black-tipped wings. These flight feathers are rich in a pigment called melanin. But melanin doesn't just provide color. It also helps make feathers stronger. Feathers with melanin have a tougher layer of keratin, the same substance found in human fingernails, compared to feathers without. So the black feathers actually help protect a wing from wear and tear. That's especially useful on the edge of a bird's wing, where air is rushing past during flight. Melanin helps the wings stay aerodynamic and efficient for birds, so they can gather food, escape from predators, and complete their long migratory journeys. While it takes energy to produce melanin, it saves birds the trouble of replacing feather after feather when traveling thousands of miles. Learn more about the pigments that bring color to bird feathers on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
You're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland.
Got troubles, I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together.